it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Today, it's a chef with the imagination of a child and the intellect of a scientist. He's England's Heston Blumenthal. Now, some people call his food bizarre, others say brilliant. We try to find out how his mind works. His new book is The Big Fat Duck Cookbook. Well, if you have no idea what is in the glass, do you think that you would pick a much-admired, high-priced wine? Robin Goldstein ran wine trials around the country to find out. A chef and his mom marked the anniversary of the day that she brought him to the United States with a French fry debate. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
And we're going to tell you about a place in Mayport, Florida called Singleton's Seafood Shack. And if you have a sibilant S like I do, that is really a tongue twister to say.
Where is Mayport? Is it on the water?
Mayport is actually a suburb or an annex of Jacksonville, Florida. And you may have heard the name if you've ever investigated the shrimping industry.
Another S.
Mayport is where most of the shrimp come in from the North Florida coast. And, you know, shrimp there are not bigger than or pinker than or in any other obvious way better than shrimp anywhere else. But they're so delicious. When you bite into one, they tend to be so fresh and so good. And like further up the coast in the low country, the people around Mayport really know how to fry seafood. So, you know, it's not all battered. It just has that thin enough veil of crust to give it an extra luscious texture.
You know, as a rule, I don't like any place that calls itself a shack, but a seafood shack, a clam shack, and occasionally Radio Shack are all okay. And Singleton Seafood Shack is the classic southern fried seafood delicioso place.
And it is indeed a shack. I mean, it's a little larger than you might expect from a shack, but you know, the word ramshackle was invented to describe it.
Has it been there a long time?
It looks like it's been there a long time. I don't know its history, but it's one of these places with a cement floor and picnic table, you know, wooden tables.
Right.
And there's a porch, a screened-in porch, where you can sit and you have a view of the fishing fleet. I mean, it's literally right on the water.
Now, Lynn, you're going to think I've flipped my wig, but, you know, as a rule, I hate fish.
I was going to bring that up. You know.
But I do like shellfish. They had the best Florida oysters fried in this just ethereal crust that snaps when you bite into it.
Is this a place where you go in and you sit down and you eat? I mean, it's not a takeout kind of thing.
Well, you go in and first of all, you walk past the case of raw seafood because it's also a seafood market.
I see.
So you walk past there, you find a seat, and then indeed there is a full menu and you're waited on by a waitress who, if she likes you, will call you dear or hon or babe.
Right.
And you get everything in abundance. And because this is also kind of North Florida, which is the American South, all the meals are accompanied by hush puppies. And also, when we were there, the vegetable of the day was collard greens. And I have to say, these are really excellent collard greens. I mean, real porky collard greens. And of course, being dadle pepper country, there were a lot of those, you know, hot peppers to sprinkle onto the collard greens to spice them up.
In vinegar on the table.
Peppers in vinegar, yeah.
Fabulous. So aside from the fact that it's the exception to Jane's shack rule, is there anything else that sets it apart?
Without a doubt, Mr. Singleton, who obviously created the place, created an annex to the restaurant that is a kind of, I would call it a museum of yar, if you remember the word yar from the Philadelphia story, meaning beautiful boats. Well, this guy's idea of beautiful boats is just a whole bunch of wooden model ships kind of arranged helter-skelter in this one room, big ones, little ones, half-finished ones, totally finished ones. My favorite exhibit in this little museum annex is three outboard motors. Now, there's no
explanation.
There's no explanation, but there are three outboard motors in a row, and I think it's sort of the history of outboard motors from early times to now, because one looks very primitive, and another looks very modern, and the other is somewhere
very
in between.
Very cryptic display.
It's kind of cryptic, but nevertheless, it really adds a certain something extra to the great food you get here.
Give me a hush puppy and a fried oyster, and I'll follow you anywhere.
Yep.
Into the shack.
Yes.
You, Lynn.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Shane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go, you know where, splendidtable.org. Yesterday afternoon, I set out to make my melting baked apples when an idea hit. Now, the melting baked apples are done with whatever apples are threatening to go over the hill. You cut them up, you core them, you don't need to peel them. And then I usually toss them with cinnamon in a baking dish. A little water is added, they're covered with foil, and they're baked low and slow until they're soft. Then I uncover them, toss them with a little sugar, and I bake them at a higher heat until the fruit is lightly caramelized and the juices have thickened a bit. Well, looking at those finished apples, it occurred to me that at this point, I could make them into pie. You would just cover them with a crust, pop them back in the oven, and bake until the crust is golden. And you'd end up with this super concentrated, melt-in-the-mouth apple pie with no soggy bottom crust. Look, I don't have a written recipe for this, but give it a try. Use apples or use pears. I think it's going to be really easy to pull off. Okay, we have got some good news about wine. Apparently, most of us actually think cheap wines taste better. When people around the country did blind tastings with bottles ranging in price from $1.50 to $150 a bottle, usually the low-priced bottles won out. These sessions were set up by Robin Goldstein and Alexis Hershkowitz, authors of the book The Wine Trials. Robin Goldstein joins us. Robin, welcome.
It's good to be here.
So this is an interesting approach where you did tastings all over the country. Could you explain how the tastings were set up? For instance, who was doing the tasting?
We had a really diverse group of people. I wanted to get people from urban and rural environments. I wanted to get people from different states and even different countries. So I held events mostly at restaurants and sometimes in private homes. And we gathered, but generally speaking, groups of 30 to 60 people, and we tasted wines in flights of six. And, of course, all of them were in brown paper bags, so nobody had any idea what they were tasting. We didn't tell them whether the wine was expensive or cheap. We didn't give any information about the grape. We didn't tell them what the producers were. So right. The idea was basically take away all the context and see what came out.
So they were tasting more or less in the way professional tasters taste wine, where they, you know, they weren't eating with them. This was totally focused on the taste of what was in the glass.
That's right. I mean, we had and it was a mix of professionals and non-experts. So we had wine people and people who were sort of everyday wine drinkers. And the questions we asked were very simple. Great, good, okay, or bad were the four choices on the overall rating of the wine. So we wanted to be really simple with the scale so that we could get the best possible data. And I developed the tasting forms with some statisticians from Stockholm and from Yale.
Did you do this? You mentioned you did this with people who were very well-educated in wine. Were their conclusions more or less the same as the people who were novices?
No, there was a statistically significant difference between the ratings of the experts and the ratings of the novices. So the experts preferred the more expensive wines by a very small margin. It was a very weak correlation, not statistically significant, whereas the everyday wine drinkers preferred the less expensive wine by a statistically significant margin. Huh. So, and the difference between them was highly significant. So that indicates to me that, you know, as people learn more about wine, they develop more expensive tastes, which isn't so surprising, I suppose. But I think for me, the surprising thing was that for everyday wine drinkers, they seem to be wasting their money if they're spending a lot of money on wine.
So some of the winners. Tell me about some of the winners.
One that really popped out was the Osborne Solaz, which is a Spanish wine. It's a red with a blend of Tempranillo and Cabernet Sauvignon. So it's sort of a big red wine, I think meant to be drunk with meat, but it's $9, and people really mistook it for a much more expensive wine in the blind tastings.
So how about a white?
Well, one of my favorites, actually, that did well in the tastings also, is a Vinho Verde from Portugal. And one of the ones that did best was Ave Leda. And basically, Vinho Verde is a, you know, meaning green wine.
Right.
Is made in a lightly effervescent style. So it's not quite sparkling, you might say, but there's some carbon dioxide in it. But it's extremely dry and highly acidic. It's meant to be served really cold, and you can even drink it over ice.
And then for a celebration wine, a sparkling wine, you're saying the Chateau Saint-Michel.
Yeah, Domaine Saint-Michel, which is a part of Chateau Saint-Michel. It's a Washington State producer. 62 people tasted the Domaine Saint-Michel against the Dom Perignon, and 41 of the 62 preferred the Domaine Saint-Michel to the Dom Perignon. So one of the fun things about doing the tastings was revealing the wines afterwards. So when we collected the forms and the pens and made sure no one could change anything that they'd written already, and then we sort of ripped open the brown paper bags and said, guess what? You rated Dom Perignon 5th out of 6. And then, of course, you can probably guess what happened next, which is, I think I must have tasted the wrong bottle. I must have gotten it wrong. Give me back that bottle again. And then immediately the Dom Perignon would disappear, even though they claimed it was one of their least favorite of the bunch. Of course, that's what they would spend the rest of the afternoon drinking.
We humans are such curious creatures, aren't we? Hey, Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Robin Goldstein is co-author of the book, The Wine Trials, 100 Wines Under $15 That Outscored 50 and $150 Bottles. Now, a dish to try with your own brown bag tests could be brick fried chicken. It's from our book, How to Eat Supper. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of our other examples of vital, essential, life-changing information. Things like our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcast, and information on our new book designed to get you to sit down and eat well with friends and family. It's called How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. And you're going to find all that at splendidtable.org. Coming up, England's science wizard in a chef's toque and secret suppers. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. British chef Heston Blumenthal is sort of a wunderkind. With little training, he opened the Fat Duck restaurant. He racked up the coveted 3 Michelin stars, a Best Restaurant in the World award, and it went on and on. And this is with nothing on the menu being what it seems. Heston broke new ground in kitchen science long before anybody was paying attention. Would you believe that he won the hearts and minds of the British with his chocolate wine, snail porridge, and egg and bacon ice cream? Yet his first book was on basic kitchen science, and it's used today in over 600 British schools. Well, his latest book is a lavish and intriguing tome called The Big Fat Duck cookbook. Heston Blumenthal, welcome.
It's great to be here.
Heston, I look through your books, and there's one thing that comes through loud and clear. You never stop questioning every detail of what cooking is about. Where does this come from? Were you like this as a kid?
No, I never was. I mean, I had this experience when I was 15 in a restaurant in France, and it was the first time we'd been out of the UK for a holiday. Uh-huh. And my folks had read about a 3-Michelin-star restaurant in Provence, and they booked a table there with myself and my sister. And this restaurant was nestled below a bauxite cliff, and it was in an olive grove, and in the background you could hear the noise of the fountain and the smell of the lavender and the sound of the feet of the waiting staff crunching on the gravel, and they were pouring sauces into souffles and carving legs of lamb at the table, and there was a cheese trolley the size of a chariot and a wine list that was like something out of a Cecil B. DeMille film, and. I was knocked for six. And from that moment, I felt that this is what I wanted to do. And I didn't realise at the time exactly what it was that I wanted to do, but I wanted to have that feeling that I had at that moment in that restaurant. And it was almost as if ever since then, I've been searching for that feeling. And sometimes we talk about things that we find perfect. Mm-hmm. And they're only perfect because it is something at a particular moment in time with all the other elements in place. And so you can never, in reality, strive for perfection. But wanting to try and get there seems to me to be the drive that just keeps me asking questions and never, ever being satisfied with what I do, which sometimes is a pain in the butt.
You're so strongly identified with what I think of as the new food science. Can you talk a little bit about how that plays and how you develop a dish? I guess what I want to do is get inside your head.
That could be a really messy job. I got into the science of cooking originally in about 1985. I bought a book written by Harold McGee.
Oh, yeah.
Called On Food and Cooking, The Science and Law of the Kitchen. It was very complicated for me to read it. When I was literally still at school. I left school with one A-level exam, and that was in art. Certainly no science background. But Harold said in this book that browning meat does not keep in the juices. And when he made that statement and went on to explain why it doesn't keep in the juices, it makes complete total sense. Of course it can't, because if browning meat kept the juices in, it would be impossible to have a dry piece of steak that was brown.
Right.
So once I'd heard this, I then started asking the question of, if this bit of classical French law is false, how many other things have I read are also false? Mm-hmm. And that really acted as a massive kind of turbo boost for my inquisitiveness. So I would say that it's almost as if I started ground up. I started with my basic food science. The next level was then actually looking at the mechanics of taste and flavor, how we move food around the mouth, how flavor's released, and that I found fascinating. And then the next level on top of that was the realization that actually, without the brain, we don't get any pleasure in food.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose if I relate that whole approach to my cooking and the food at the Fat Duck today, it is that it starts at the base. So we have to get the foundation of the dish and the mechanics of the dish as best as we can. And that could involve how the textural elements of a dish play against each other, looking at the flavor release. We balance is there enough acidity to generate saliva in the mouth? Because that makes our food taste more juicy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start looking, the next layer up is a sort of flavor combinations. And then the icing on the cake is how it's served, the packaging, the whole kind of multi-sensory elements, using sights and sounds, smells, all of this sort of thing.
I've heard you actually put an iPod on the table with one of your dishes.
There is an iPod with a dish. The dish is called Sound of the Sea. And if you can imagine the plate of food, it's served on a shadow box. And on that, we put sand, which is actually a mixture of tapioca. It's a small anchovies that have been fried and ground up.
Oh,
three types of seaweed crystallized, miso oil. It's got waffle cone. It looks just like sand. And then that runs vertically along down the plate.
Right.
Alongside that, we take the juices from the seafood that we're using in the dish plus an infusion of kombu seaweed, and then froth that up and spoon that over the edge. It looks like the sea's lapping up against the shore.
Oh, the foam that comes up on the sand when the waves come up.
Yeah. Exactly. And then on top of the sand, we've got three different types of seaweed. There's samphire, there's oysters, sometimes sea urchins, sometimes razor clams. And this gets placed on the table. And then on the side of it, we have a big seashell. And inside the seashell, we tuck a little iPod that we've had a sound engineer record the sound of the waves lapping up against the shore with the noise of seagulls. And so the diner pops the earphones in and listens to this and then starts eating. And, you know, amazing thing, we showcase this for the first time at a charity dinner in Las Vegas, Table of Ten. And we'd actually put a fan. We don't do this in the restaurant, but we put a fan at the end of the table, which you brush essential oil of seaweed on. So they got the sea breeze while they're eating. But what was amazing was I left the table hearing this Table of Ten. They were very wealthy, very dignified older people,
right,
that were just, they were behaving like kids in the most wonderful way. They were arguing about where they were. Somebody was in Sardinia, somebody else was in Maine, somebody else was on a holiday in the south of France. It was fantastic.
It doesn't sound like the Fat Duck is a very stuffy place to eat.
Oh, no. You know, I think it's the most important thing of all. If I could have one emotion that I wanted all my diners to have when they left the restaurant, it would just be this overriding sense of fun.
Heston, thanks so much for talking with us.
That's a pleasure.
Heston Blumenthal is chef owner of The Fat Duck in Bray, England. His new book is The Big Fat Duck Cookbook. When people talk food in Portland, Oregon, Paley's Place always comes up. It's a restaurant-come-local institution run by a husband and wife team, Chef Vitaly Paley and his wife Kimberly. Russian-born Vitaly originally trained to be a concert pianist. Kimberly was a dancer studying with Martha Graham. They met in New York City. They claimed that they didn't choose food, it chose them. But when they moved west, they discovered that Portland was in the middle of a local product nirvana. And that shaped the restaurant. Well, now there's a book, The Paley's Place Cookbook, Recipes and Stories from the Pacific Northwest. Vitaly Paley joins us. Vitaly, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So in this book, you talk about the farmers you work with, how your food works, you give recipes. And then out of the blue, there's this story about your mom. How did you come to this?
When we put a proposal together for the book, I took note of several things that happened in my life. And this was a particularly special moment that I really wanted to capture. My mom and I celebrate our anniversary of coming to this country every year, but this particular year was a very special one. She asked me to come back to New York and celebrate 30 years in this country with her. Hmm. And it was just such a special gathering. I really had to put it on paper.
Now, where did you two come from?
We came from the former Soviet Union. And the story is called Why Are French Fries American? And so I go into this story about telling how I think French fries are American through the eyes of immigrants who are standing in this apartment in Battery Park City looking out to a view of Ellis Island. And it just, every time I think of it, it just sends chills up my spine.
It's sending chills up my spine because that means they can also see the Statue of Liberty. This is the lower part of New York, the west side of the island. I know the area. So tell me the story.
You know, every year she goes to celebrate, or we actually used it together, to this place called Cafe America. And it is closed, unfortunately. And rather than looking for another place, I offered to come home and to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And along with just me and her, she invited quite a bit of our friends and family. I would say 20 of us were in that tiny studio apartment.
Uh-huh.
And I proposed a menu. I proposed a burger, except I really wanted to bring in some of what we had here locally and brought in some Kobe beef from you know, Eastern Oregon and right. brought in some burger buns that we make, and I brought some my own homemade ketchup. And, of course, we packed wine with us. How could you not arrive without Oregon wines?
Right.
And my pastry chef made a really nice carrot cake, and we brought some oysters. So we did a bunch of different things that really represented the Northwest, but also, in my opinion, were really American. And we brought some Dungeness crab with us, and we had a
Holy
crab cocktail.
Cow.
I mean, it was. We went all out for sure. Yeah, but the focus of the dinner, it was like the Italians have this antipasto thing. So all these things were antipasto for a main course, which was French fries, and the whole dinner really centered over French fries. It was what we did before we cooked French fries, and what we did after we ate French fries. And the rest of the story is about me describing why I think French fries are not French at all.
Tell me the story. Why do you think French fries are not French?
Well, it went all the way back to World War I, when the American soldiers were stationed in Belgium, and the famous street snack of these pommes frites is what they really loved. And they loved the idea so much, they brought it back into this country. And so that's kind of where it all began. Thomas Jefferson, of course, known Francophile, served French fries in Monticello and called them potatoes fried in French manner. I mean, that's how deep and how far this goes in our history. And then when the French fries actually became popular, and I have to give credit where credit is due, is Ray Kroc. Of course, we all know the McDonald's.
Right,
And so something that was brought from France all of a sudden became American because American ingenuity, American know-how, American marketing genius made this happen.
Well, there is a basic logic to this meal I adore. What happened before the French fries? What happened after the French fries? We know what's important.
Exactly.
Vitaly, your mother must be so proud of you.
I think so. I thank my mother for bringing me into this country quite often. She really put her own feelings aside when she decided to make this monumental change in life. Mm-hmm. I was a young kid when I came here. And so for me, it was one big adventure. We went through Italy. We went through Austria. I call my time in Italy my Roman holiday. I really, really loved that portion of it. But when it's all said and done, we created a new life here. And she did it because of me. And so I really have to give my mom credit for that. She really wanted a house with a white picket fence for us. And you know, this is an American dream that we're living, and it's very special.
It sounds lovely. And congratulations on 30 years.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chef Vitaly Paley is co-author of the Paley's Place Cookbook. Now, you can find Vitaly's recipe for those American French fries on the website, splendidtable.org. There's a new way of eating out, and it's got a mystery angle to it. Food writer Jen Garby went to her first underground dinner in San Francisco, and then she started tracking them all over the country. Her finds are in her book, Secret Suppers, Rogue Chefs and Underground Restaurants in Warehouses, Townhouses, Open Fields, and Everywhere in Between. Jen, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So explain what you're talking about here. What exactly is an underground restaurant?
Well, you know, if you ask five different people, you're going to get that many definitions. I like to think of it as film noir for food, in a sense, because it's outside the normal boundaries of dining. And it's kind of like, even on the food end, you never quite know what you're going to expect when you walk in the door. You can have this crazy bacon-wrapped bacon or bubblegum caviar, but also you can go to someone's home and have a very classic, lovely six-course meal with pasta bolognese. It really depends on the person who's throwing it. And I think that in general, though, an underground restaurant is something that is somewhere in between a restaurant and a home dinner party, in the sense that you're paying a set amount for that meal, often as a donation, in quotes, that's asked for at the end of the meal. And you're also signing up somehow for that dinner. So you're walking into this situation like a restaurant where you don't necessarily know anyone around the table, but you're sitting down and having this very involved, long dinner.
Now, are these always in people's homes?
Not always. You know, they actually, a lot of them rove around different places. It's part of how people get around health inspectors. I've been to some in attics. I've been to some outdoor fields. It just depends. It's certainly easier as a host to throw it in your home, but it can get a little sticky if you do it there too often. You're stepping into the restaurant world a little too much.
Who does these? Who are these people?
You know, it's the same, you know, I hate to tell you the same thing again, but it's such a varied group of people, from executives who want to throw once a month dinner parties because maybe they're traveling all the time and busy. And this is a way for them to meet people, to at times there's chefs that are getting involved in this. Also sous chefs that are going to be working the line for the next, say, 7 or 8 years, and they're not going to get to be the head chef for quite some time. So the opportunity for them to throw an underground restaurant is to cook whatever they want. So who throws them is really dependent on what type of underground it is and what they're trying to get out of it.
Can you give us a specific picture? You know, pick one maybe.
Well, one of my favorite ones I went to is actually one of the first in San Francisco, and it's called Cook with James. And James and his wife throw these dinners, very elaborate dinners, every, say, 6 to 8 weeks. And the reason it's so infrequently held is because of the amount of work he puts into it. His wife is Italian, and James works as an advertising executive. And they put together these really elaborate 6-course Italian meals. And you feel like by the end of the night, they're going to be pulling out the vin santo. You've been there. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. You've met all these people. You almost forget that you're paying for this experience. And his wife, Pia, is fluttering around and playing the hostess. And a friend down the street brings these beautiful flowers. And James goes to the market and gets the most amazing ingredients. And he even invites the purveyors, say like the meat purveyor for that night's bolognese sauce, when he can, to come in and join the table. So it's just really this fabulous. It's kind of, you know, when you walk into these, no matter how comfortable it is, it's a little unsettling because you're not quite sure what to expect. And then you sit down at the table and immediately you feel like you've known all these people all along and these are your friends. And you just spend this long, involved evening where at a restaurant you could never do that, in the sense of even staying that long and getting to know the people around you. And so that was one of my favorites for sure.
How do you find out about these dinners?
You know, that is actually thinking that the word underground is a little deceiving, I think, in that. It's surprisingly easy. I found that many of them have websites, which seems counterintuitive, but you can actually go on, use a search engine, find them, look for different cities. I found a lot just scouring local newspaper articles. Also, a great way to find them is to ask local chefs, culinary students. I ask at the farmer's market. It's very word of mouth. And once someone knows you're looking for them, you'll just find people just start telling you about them. Because there is this little kind of subculture of the underground world. And if they let you in, they want you to know about the other ones out there.
Do you think this is a sign of what's happening to the economy?
I don't know if it's much about the economy as I actually felt it was a change in the way we socially interact. You know, we're so busy and we don't have time to throw elaborate dinner parties as often and gather with people. And yet we're wanting to spend time cooking. And as a result of also the internet, our social networks have changed. And we know all of these people online, but we don't spend time with people the way, you know, our parents did. You know, it is great fun, experimental food, but it was a way for people to gather in the way and have a classic dinner party and really get to meet new people that was so universally linking all of these undergrounds.
Interesting. Jen, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jen Garby is author of Secret Suppers. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week the question is, what is the connection between Colonel Sanders and the next step in treating high blood pressure? Well, we're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the connection between Colonel Sanders and the next step in treating high blood pressure? Well, it's chicken legs, but sorry, KFC, not fried ones. Reuters reported that Japanese researchers found four proteins in the collagen contained in chicken legs that might lower blood pressure. They ran a test by feeding the collagen to rats with high blood pressure. 4 weeks later, they had lower blood pressure and wonderfully smooth skin. That's my addition, because collagen is the dream of every woman over 40. Look, don't swoop up every chicken leg in the market yet. We don't have any more scientific information here. And there is one other comment I should share. The study was jointly undertaken by Hiroshima University and the Nippon Meatpackers Research and Development Center. Why am I not surprised? We're opening the lines to your calls, brought to you by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice at palmwonderful.com. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is calling. We have got Sarah on the line from Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Sarah, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk about duck eggs today.
Where are you getting duck eggs?
I live in a semi-rural area outside of Columbus, and sometime last year my neighbor took on a Muscovy duck.
Ooh.
And she spends a lot of time at our house, and I noticed earlier...
Wait a minute, the neighbor or the duck?
Both.
Oh, okay.
More the duck. I noticed the duck had been nosing around, looking, it seemed like she was looking for somewhere to roost.
Uh-huh.
And she has chosen to spend her time in a box that I had put out for one of my cats.
Oh, golly. So I think I know what's coming next. She laid eggs.
She laid eggs. And I had talked to a friend who said that maybe they weren't the best to eat straight up, but that they could be good for baking. And I did bake a cake with them, and couldn't say that I noticed any difference. But I wondered if there was anything special that could be done with them to really appreciate their flavor.
Well, the thing about duck eggs, and of course, you know, a lot of what influences the taste of the egg is what the animal's been eating and which animal it is.
Mm.
When I have to say that when I think of Muscovy duck, I immediately think of fabulous sautéed duck breast. But this may not be the direction either
no.
you or your neighbor want to go in. But anyway, duck eggs are richer than chicken eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So... If you, I mean, it's like everything else. If you really want to taste them, the loveliest way to do it would be to have them, you know, scrambled or just, you know, cooked until they're just a little beyond the soft boiled. So you get the pure flavor. And I haven't had a duck egg in a long time, but what I remember was they were lovely and kind of lush tasting.
Mm-hmm.
I must say one thing that occurs to me when you say duck egg, I immediately think... You could. They're bigger, right? They're bigger.
A little bit,
than, yeah. And I'm thinking deviled eggs, because the richness of that yolk, you could cut back a bit on the mayo, increase, you know, it'll do a little lemon, and you could have a really nice deviled egg.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and then do what you're doing, which is, you know, essentially baking with them. I imagine a pound cake done with them would probably be really lovely. But it's not a huge difference. A duck egg is not, you know, hugely different than a chicken egg.
Okay. Well, super. Yeah, the recipe that I did make was a sour cream coffee cake.
Yeah, well, it could be bad.
Yeah, right. And the friend did suggest that maybe they made things a little fluffier. So I was...
Which is possible, because there's a little bit more fat, and the fat gives structure
okay.
to a point.
Okay.
What's the duck's name, by the way?
Brownie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Just beautiful variation in brown feathers, and So we just gave her the simple name.
Well, thanks for a great question.
Thank
and enjoy
you.
The duck eggs.
I shall.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We got an email this week from Jim, who lives in Jersey City, New Jersey. Now, he said, we know about brining chicken and pork, but why don't we know about brining beef, veal, and lamb? What happens to the texture and the flavor? Well, I think you don't see as much brining of lamb, veal, and beef, and especially beef and lamb. Brining is what you use for foods that have a tendency to be very lean and that can dry out in cooking. I think so much beef has so much marbling that often you don't see a need for brining. And also that can be true of lamb. And veal, well, veal is very young. And veal tends to take to nicely to brining, but I think because people go for the very delicate flavor of veal, they don't tend to brine it. Because as we know, brining is mixing salt and water, maybe with flavorings, and letting the meat sit in it so that it is actually absorbing the salt and the liquid. And this plumps out the cells of the meat, keeps them moist, and keeps them juicy. So I think the reason you don't see a lot of this being brined is because it's already well marbled with fat. But if you have a super lean piece of meat, you could brine it. And thanks for a great question, Jim. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got April on the line from Waterbury, Vermont. April, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I am calling because I am the mother of three children under five.
Yeah.
And needless to say, snack food plays a huge role in our lives and recently in our budgets, and most specifically, granola bars.
Oh, yeah.
I have been starting to make granola bars myself, but I can't find a good recipe for chewy granola bars, which are my children's favorites, that, you know, doesn't call for corn syrup or if there's some sort of, I'm looking for something that can make them that lovely, sticky, chewy consistency.
Yeah, yeah.
That isn't just overly sweet.
Ooh, that's tricky, because what I'm thinking is, I was thinking of honey.
Right.
But it's still going to be sweet.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously the sweet is what makes them dive right in.
Right,
and
right.
And their favorite is our chocolate chip granola bars. The organic ones we buy use tapioca syrup, but that might be a little hard to come by.
Yeah. Rice syrup. The other thing that comes to mind is rice syrup, which you can find in. And now you're in Waterbury. You know, health food stores, co-ops, that kind of thing might have something. One thing, though, I was wondering is, you know, if you boil honey and then stir in, it's sweet.
Right. My mother-in-law had a suggestion of marshmallow fluff, which made us all laugh, but then I thought, well, actually, Rice Krispie treats are kind of the consistency of...
Yeah, but it's pure sugar.
But again, pure sugar.
And it's corn syrup,
usually. And it is corn syrup. I'm wondering if sugar syrup, if I made a syrup out of sugar, would that burn too easily, or...
Well, it burns, but the idea is that you can control that.
Right.
So you can take that to the point where, you know, it's just starting to caramelize, and then immediately you stir in the granola and you pull it off the heat and you turn it out in a pan. But if you take that syrup a little too far, when it cools, it'll be hard.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with honey, if you boil honey, it still will remain slightly sticky and gooey.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I favor the honey.
Right.
And there may be a few nutrients in there that you like. But the other thing, and I've not tried this, but I would check rice syrup.
Okay.
See if you can, you know, if there's anything. And you may find that tapioca syrup as well.
Right.
Now, whether or not they're more nutritious, I'm not a nutritionist, so that I'm not sure. But you can find that information, you know, in 100 places.
That's true. And, you know, I mean, let's be honest, they're not exactly the healthiest of snacks, so
maybe
I could be just as well off. Maybe I should just make a pan of blondies or, you know, a couple of sheets of chocolate chip cookies and call it good.
Yeah, but the other thing is it's a great way of getting whole grains into kids.
That's true. That's
and
true.
Even if there's the occasional chocolate chip, there can be the dried fruit, but there can also be, you know, whole grains of all kinds, toasted flax seed and, you know, oats and wheat and all that, whatever you feel you want those kids to have.
Right.
And if you season it enough and you make it interesting enough, they'll eat it.
And they can help.
Yes,
exactly. So does this go into the oven at all, or do we just put
I think you would just add the granola to it And then I would spread it out on a sheet that you've lightly oiled, let it cool down and cut it up.
Ah, great.
And, you know, do a small amount first and just make sure it works. Because I've not done this. I'm just applying theory to it.
Right.
But I think it's, you know, it's certainly worth a shot.
I think so, too. Well,
and by the way,
so much.
Yeah. I love marshmallow fluff, so I'm just, you know, a pushover. But it, I don't think it's going to do what you want it to do.
Right. Okay, I'll let her know.
Hey,
thank
April.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Well, I missed the memo again. Until I came across Charles Perry's article in the LA Times, I hadn't a clue that you could not only cook with mesquite, but that you could eat it too. Now, Charles is one of those knower of all things culinary types, from California barbecue to medieval Arab cuisine. But his piece about eating mesquite, I have to say, took me by surprise. Well, I've got Charles on the phone. Charles, welcome.
Hi.
So how long has this mesquite thing been going on?
Well, as long as people have been able to find the pods, they're sweet and tasty. They grow out in desert areas, and it's a real staple for a lot of Native American groups. It came to this country as a food in around 1990, basically in health food stores, because mesquite is one of the few things that can make gluten-free baking tolerable at all.
Now, why is that? Is it the flavor of it, or does it have any gluten-like properties?
It has flavor, and it has fiber, and it's very hard to get both those things in gluten-free cooking.
All right, so we burn the wood, but we eat the pod. Is that the way it works?
Right. It's a lot like carob. They're first cousins, except it has a slightly different flavor. It's got that sort of roasted chocolate kind of flavor, but to me, there's also kind of a something like dried cherries and maybe coconut.
Well, that sounds pretty fabulous. So the way you eat it, I mean, do you have to bake with it? Do you have to add it? It's a flour, or do you boil the pods, for instance, and eat them as a vegetable?
You get it as a ground meal, and you could just sprinkle it on things. I sprinkle it on oat bran. I sprinkle it on pork chops.
Ooh.
Pork and shrimp are really good with it because they like sweet accompaniments.
Mm. Has anybody dug into the science behind this?
Oh, yeah. There's a scientist named Gary Takioka who was telling me that he's at the USDA, but mm-hmm. they had not yet figured out all the aromatic compounds in it. There's apparently the flavor is based on something that has not been studied by scientists before. And there are a lot of biologists who have been studying it because it's called an extremophile. It's a plant that loves harsh environments. It will grow where the soil is too alkaline and too salty for anything else. There are some mesquites that will grow where the soil is as salty as seawater. And they have great hopes for it in very arid, deserty kind of climates. Of course, it's a tough plant for a tough environment, and once it gets established somewhere, it's pretty hard to take out.
Mm-hmm.
So you better plan very carefully.
So now, look, let's get down to the fun of it. How do you cook with it?
In the Times Test Kitchen, they cook some spare ribs, mesquite spare ribs without mesquite charcoal. And what they did was they made a classic barbecue rub, which is sugar, salt, and pepper, only they replaced the sugar with mesquite.
Ooh.
And then they baked it with a sort of a Caribbean flavoring of coconut and rum and citrus juices and mustard.
You say in the article that the mesquite really gets on well with all the citrus family.
Yes, it goes well with citrus. It goes well with anything where you would like a sort of a sweet, fruity, roasty kind of flavor. So there are obviously a lot of dishes that could be inspired by Caribbean or Southeast Asian cuisine.
Mm. You know, I'm thinking, wouldn't it be great in a gingerbread recipe?
Boy, that's a wonderful idea. And I was just thinking this morning, maybe I should try it putting in a cake frosting.
Oh, wow, that could be fabulous in a frosting.
Yeah.
So where can we get our hands on this stuff?
It's easy to find on the internet. You can just search for mesquite. They got it on Amazon.
Okay.
I got mine from a company called Casa de Fruta, which is casadefruta.com.
Uh-huh.
So it's pretty easy to find on the internet if it's not in your local health food store.
Charles, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Food historian Charles Perry recently retired as food writer for the LA Times. His article on mesquite flour appeared in the March 12th 2008 issue of the paper. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this from Robert Foss. He said, "It would be nice if the Food and Drug Administration stopped issuing warnings about toxic substances and just gave me the names of the one or two things still safe to eat." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find priceless newsletters and podcasts, you will find information on our must-have new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. That title says it all. Well, check it all out online, splendidtable.org. Our show is supported in part by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice backed by $25 million in medical research. You can learn more about the antioxidant superpower at palmwonderful.com. Palm Wonderful, trust in Palm. And by Gather.com, the social network with substance where people connect around their interests. People are talking about cooking at Gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. And our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.